This podcast is brought to you by Audible. Please visit audiblepodcast.com/GOT for your free audiobook download. Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 5, Episode 4, entitled Sons of the Harpy.
Son of a Harpy?
How'd you like this episode?
I liked it. I liked it a lot. I felt like there was two episodes worth of content. The time just kind of... But it didn't feel long. It just felt like it was just super packed with a lot of interesting things happening. Mm-hmm. And a lot of really great quiet character moments. The parts with like Stannis and Shireen were awesome.
Sure, but also some really epic stuff, like possible death of Grey Worm and Ser Barristan.
Possible shocking death of, or maybe not so shocking, mildly interesting, whatever.
Yeah.
I still haven't gotten over it.
It was pretty amazing, though, as a show-only viewer.
Uh-huh.
I liked it.
Yeah.
Do you have anything to start with, or should we get right into the recap?
Yeah, it was directed by Mark Millar. Same thing. Oh my God, it's Mark Millar. He directed the previous one as well. It was written by Dave Hill, which I found a tough time finding any information about him. It turns out this guy was the Double D's personal assistant on the set for these last few seasons. Hmm. And he got this gig. There's an interview in Variety Magazine from August 2014. Where the Double D's were recounting his history, and he says, "We have this assistant named Dave Hill," said Benioff and Weiss. I don't know if they said that in unison, like binars or what, but
probably.
You know, this is what I'm just reporting on what Variety reported. One day last summer, he walked into her office and said, "You know that kid, Ollie, whose family gets massacred by the wildlings? The one who runs the Castle Black and let them know the wildlings are nearby?" "Yeah." "Well," said Dave, "doesn't it make sense that he'd stay at Castle Black and become a Night's Watch recruit? What else is he going to do?" "You're right," we said. "That does make sense. And what if during the battle for Castle Black, he's the one that ends up killing Ygritte?" This year, Dave Hill is a writer on the show. So apparently they're so impressed by this guy's chops that they gave him an episode to write. And that was this episode. And I think he did a hell of a job.
Good idea, kid. We're going to put you in the writer's room.
Yeah, see? Yeah. but yeah, this is his first screen credit.
Okay, cool. Well, not a half bad job.
No, I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
All right, let's get into the recap.
Before we do, I want to talk about the title sequence, because we had a new location.
Oh, yeah, we did.
Dorne, weirdly named. It's like they don't say the North when they go into Winterfell. I mean, Dorne is a goddamn region. Okay. I believe what they're showing us is the capital of Sunspear.
Ah.
Because it has the spear with a snake crawling up it, which I thought was cool. But the other thing is the way they're doing this map reveal is really confusing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I the way the old stuff worked, you know, like north was north, and then you swope over to sea, and you could kind of see where things laid out. But now they kind of have this clockwise rotation that starts at King's Landing, like at the 9 o'clock position, and the Narrow Sea is in the middle, and then we sweep up to Winterfell, and then to the Wall, and then over to Braavos, and then down to Meereen, and then back across the Narrow Sea to the little tiny peninsula at the end of Westeros, which is Dorne. So just by the time you're over in Essos, remember that now what's up is south, and you're actually sweeping down south.
Yeah, it's really strange.
I don't know why they don't. That's such a useful way to kind of center everyone in the world and kind of show where it's in the map. And I don't know why it seems like they're doing these weird swooping camera moves that are, because I laid that out to you and you're like, get the hell out.
Yeah, it didn't make any sense. You said, oh, that they're actually going north now when it looks like they're going south or whatever. And I'm like, that, okay, I guess if you know where this stuff is, but I didn't get that from the intro.
I should have asked you to draw a map of what you think on the whiteboard, and we could have taken a picture of it, but oh well. Everyone could have laughed at Jim. That's always fun.
All right, let's get into the recap.
Some boat stealing.
I'm going to call it renting a boat.
Ah.
Yeah?
Or maybe a forceful negotiation for the boat's price.
Okay, yeah. Jorah.
Guy wakes up. This is worth more than two dragons and a stag? What the fuck?
Yeah, Jorah buys a boat from a man in Volantis, and he takes off with Tyrion.
Uh-huh.
You know, and by buying, I mean, he knocks him out and drops a couple coins on his chest. That was really funny. There's a lot of entertaining stuff in this episode, too.
I also just liked, in second watch, I noticed that Jorah had, like, staked him to the beach with a sword. And then when he came over to get Tyrion after he negotiated a price of the boat, Tyrion was, like, frantically trying to...
Oh, yeah, to get his
And then,
hands
like,
loose.
What was Tyrion's end game there? You know...
I don't know why you need your hands to run.
Well...
Maybe he's got his legs tied too, and he needs to get his hands free to untie.
Probably, okay. But also you're a dwarf, and it's the sand dunes. I don't think you're going to outrun Longshanks over here anytime soon.
Yeah, probably not.
But you gotta, you know, you gotta try
at least.
Tyrion.
Then we go over to Bronn and Jaime in their boat, and
much bigger boat.
Yes, Bronn's questioning Jaime about where they're going, what they're doing, and he says, you know, we're going to Dorne to rescue Myrcella. And he thinks it's a pretty bad idea for Jaime to have come here himself.
It seems like a pretty bad idea.
He's pretty recognizable.
And he's a shitty fighter.
He is.
At this point.
He is. And I like later on how he tries to disguise himself at least a little bit by putting a glove on.
Right.
So he's not just, oh, there's the one-handed man.
Yeah, with the gold hand. Who could that be? He's taking a page, but he does, a little, you know, him and Tyrion have a lot in common. As far as keeping a low profile.
Definitely.
I also like, before they got into this part, how they sailed past the Tarth, which is Brienne's home, the Sapphire Island.
Okay.
And Jaime had a wistful look on his face.
Mm-hmm.
A very subtle way to show that connection between the two characters without having them share a screen.
So he's still thinking about her.
I think so.
One way or another here.
I think so.
All right. He's also thinking about what a shit Tyrion is. You know, he's, as we discussed in the instant cast, he's not super on board with the idea that Tyrion killed Tywin.
Yeah.
I was kind of surprised by that.
Frankly. It's surprise is a good way to put it. I kind of thought that maybe Jaime would be less surprised, and it's hard for me to separate my view of, you know, Jaime in the book versus Jaime in the show, because there are some subtle differences between their motivations and how things went between him and Tyrion. So with show Jaime, I was surprised to see him being that kind of bitter about the whole situation.
Yeah. It really, I'm imagining that some point they're going to have to meet back up. Like, I can't imagine that they put that in the show and say, you know, I'm going to cut him in two and then I'll give him your regards if there's no reason for it.
Well, you know,
if it's going nowhere.
That seems like it'd be at least a mildly interesting scene if we ever get there.
I would think so. All right. Cersei meets with the small council. The governor of the master of coin, says the Iron Bank has called in a lot of their debt, 1/10 of their debt, mm-hmm. and they can't afford that.
Which is amazing. You can't pay off 1/10 of the crown's debts, not even half of it.
Sure. Yeah, they're in a lot of debt.
Sure.
He suggests that, you know, the Tyrell family could lend you money. Cersei turns that down and then says, no, I want you to go negotiate with the Iron Bank personally, and I'm sending you with Meryn Trant to go do that.
What did you think of the comedy stylings of Mace Tyrell?
I find him lovably doofusy. I don't know.
Kind of a little, like, drunk uncle.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll give my regards to the Titan of Braavos.
Nobody's finding it funny.
If you don't pay back the crown, I'll have to be very stern with my daughter. I mean, come on,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, it's silly. I have a lot of questions here, because clearly Cersei has a plan for
it
him.
It seems so.
Is her plan... I wonder if her plan is to buy some time from the Iron Bank, or if she actually wants him to go over there and negotiate a better rate or whatever from the bank, or if she's going to potentially have Meryn Trant kill him, either on the way there or on the way back, more likely, and use his death for some purpose. Now, it could be tied in with the idea that she's, you know, by proxy kidnapped Loras this episode.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. It seems like all-out war on the Tyrell family right now, and that doesn't bode well for Mace.
But we want to know, like, how dark does it get? Is she actually... Because we know Sir Meryn Trant has a checkered history. He's not... he seems to be on the cowardly, skulky, blackguard end of the Kingsguard.
Oh, yeah.
You know, more of a blackguard than a Kingsguard. And so the hint of a threat there to Mace's life. Plus, From what we see of him and what an idiot he is, it seems unlikely that Cersei would send him over there to seriously barter for them. Because
I think you're right.
Because I think you next get a raven being like, yeah, we're calling all the debt back. This is your master of coin. We're calling them all
this
back.
This is the guy you've got running?
Yeah.
No, we're cutting.
We have no faith.
Cutting our losses.
No
here.
Confidence. Yeah. You guys are bankrupt now.
The other thing is this comment about, you know, the small council getting smaller and smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Cersei saying not small enough. Is she trying to consolidate power for herself?
I think it's a subtle threat to Pycelle. Because he seems to be, hold on to your ass. Mm-hmm. Grandmeister Pycelle might be the best advisor she has left. And he's trying to subtly, like, it's all fun and games when we're kind of running shit and taking advantage of this and being rich and powerful. But... you're taking it too far, lady.
Yeah.
And Cersei just reminds him that, hey, small council can get smaller.
But to be so bold as to say that to him, I get that there's nothing he can really do if she wants him gone
right.
in some capacity. But I also feel like Cersei is purposely doing this with the small council, appointing people where they don't belong.
Sure.
Sending people on missions that are probably death sentences. And appointing Qyburn as... kind of the one person that she actually wants on the small council.
But he's her lackey.
Absolutely. Yeah. So she seems like she's consolidating power. I don't know where that'll go, but
I'm kind of curious myself. I also like the symmetry between last season Iron Bank loaning money to Stannis. And I kind of feel like I wonder if there's a charter that, like, you know, 10,000 gold dragons to Stannis. We need 10,000 gold dragons back. It's like, that would make it even a bigger fuck you.
Uh-huh.
Like, not only are we...
you're paying for someone to come and sack your throne.
Your city. I love that. I mean, again, that's something I've entirely made up in my head, but I love that angle of the Iron Bank. They're like, don't pay your debts. See where it gets you. It'd be a shame. You got a nice King's Landing here. It'd be a shame if it got busted up, wouldn't it?
At the very least, the Iron Bank is playing both sides.
Yeah.
You know, they're hedging their bets here. I like it. Cersei meets with the High Sparrow to appoint him as the leader of what she calls the Faith Militant, a faction that I had not heard of before, but apparently has been around for a very long time.
Well, it hasn't been around for a very long time.
Yes, it was around a long time ago, took a hiatus, and is coming back now in full force.
Yeah.
Then the Sparrows immediately go out and start killing the sinners.
Yeah.
And they also capture Loras.
Right.
Which... I think everybody understands the implication of that, including Margaery in the next scene, but we'll talk about that when we get there. Here are the dongs you requested, sir.
Dude.
Front and center. The very next episode. It says if they can listen to our podcast.
I want to speak for the ladies and the gay bros. I am not happy with this
dick. No, you're right.
Like, in this episode alone, we get the glorious display of Melisandre, full frontal.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And they get these shriveled, raisinette,
old
dancer
Batman
dicks.
Yeah,
this is unjust. The dick count stands at Hodor and these two randos. Mm-hmm. I would be insulted if I was a lady or a lusty gay man.
All right, well, at least they're not afraid to show some dick, right?
And they do show some shapely male figures, to be fair.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's our fault for having external genitalia. Because when we say full frontal, it's not like they're spreading their legs and like, you know, it's you get some bush, you might get a little mound.
Most of the actual genitals are hidden.
Like if these guys tucked, like if Loras would tuck his dick, and I'm sure they would show that, right?
Probably.
They'd Buffalo Bill that. So maybe it's just our fault for having the, it's just too explicit.
Okay, yeah.
We're rocking out with our cocks out, and it's biology's fault, not the showrunners.
Fair. All right, Marjorie goes to Tommen.
Is it? Because sounds
totally
insane.
Not.
Okay.
I'm humoring all right. you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Marjorie goes to Tommen to tell him that Cersei is holding her brother prisoner, and Tommen promises to get him free. And so he goes to Cersei to ask for his release. And instead, she says, no, go ask the High Sparrow yourself. I'm not holding him, which is silly. And Tommen,
and poor Tommen.
You know, if Tommen were any older and more capable of making this argument,
yeah,
he would shut Cersei down here in a second. But. Yeah. You know, he's a kid. What's
he
gonna do?
And I just felt bad for him because, you know, as good as he felt last episode, he feels just completely between this rock and a hard place. He wants desperately to make Marjorie happy. He's already, you know, written checks that his ass can't cash. You know, like apparently he'd made promises about shipping his mother off to Casterly Rock. He can't do that. I mean, he could, but he lacks. I don't know. It's complicated. And. You think about what you would do if you were Tommen in this situation versus, you know, I don't know. I just really felt for the guy. He's in an impossible situation.
Yeah, he honestly, Tommen feels like a good kid. And
yes.
I think he does want his mother to be happy. And if his mother tells him, I wouldn't be happy at Casterly Rock, this is my home now, I don't know that he would feel right shipping her off, regardless of the promise that he has made to anyone.
Yep.
So I think that's why she's still around. A little bit of guilt there.
And he's young.
Part.
He's like, what, 14, 15?
Yeah, and Cersei's a fairly intimidating person.
Sure.
Trying to stand up to her.
Sure.
Even when you're the king, if you're a kid, it's tough.
Yeah. Especially since you weren't even king, and you didn't even have any designs on being a king a year ago.
You expected not to be.
Yeah, you're going to be a prince, and you know you were still playing with your kittens and all that. But, you know, I don't. Like I said, I feel bad for him.
Yeah, speaking of feeling bad for him, he then goes to the High Sparrow where he's staying and tries to talk to him, but they turn him away because he's praying. Or so they say. You seem to have an idea that you suggested during the Instacast that maybe he wasn't praying.
It's a theory. It's a theory that perhaps the High Sparrow has been taken over by radical elements because... Mm. Otherwise, we're left with a guy who's... I mean, again, I keep liking the High Sparrow. I like the scene with him and Cersei. He seems willing to take advantage of whatever Cersei's offering. But he doesn't seem evil. And he seemed to express contrition about the way they went about exposing the sinner in their midst.
And that
earlier.
Was just a beating.
That was just a beating. Now they've got the Faith Militant, and they're just rampaging through King's Landing.
Yeah.
I just wonder how much of this is... Because why wouldn't this High Septon see the king? Like, why would they be that aggressive about protecting him?
I don't know. I mean, how seriously do they take their prayer?
Well, I mean, obviously they're carving seven-sided stars on their fucking forehead.
Their religion is a pretty serious thing for them.
I do
find it hard to buy that just the guys praying... would be enough.
Yeah, because the other thing is, I don't know what the size and strength of the Faith Militant and like how far their deputies, and also how can you tell the official versus the unofficial. But I kind of feel like between the Lannister House Guard, the Gold Cloaks, and the King's Guard, they could just clear house if they wanted to.
Yeah.
In fact, I think that the King's Guard could have taken every one of those dudes on a step. They got hammers, King's Guard's got plate mail and swords.
Yeah,
serious.
They're
going to
kick their asses up and down. It's clear to me. So, yes, I mean, the reason that doesn't happen there is because Tommen is too nice, doesn't want to see these people killed.
Well, not only that, but he's also, like, at the Great Sept. I mean, that was something. He probably remembers how shocking it was that Joffrey had Ned Stark beheaded, and it'd be essentially like the Pope executing someone in St. Peter's Cathedral. Like, yeah. It's just, this is a house of worship. God damn it. So then he's already feeling uneasy about it, and then the crowd starts up with the bastard abomination, which I wonder if he even knows. Like, how, as protective as Cersei is of people, I wonder if he even knows what the hell is going on.
Like, that's a fair question.
How aware he's been, like, you know, when, because he's paraded through the streets and it's all, oh, Queen Marjorie, King Tom, and this might be the first he's experienced that.
And it shows how, you know, word is really getting around. It's becoming more common knowledge about what's going on in that family.
But, you know, you can see that this is a runaway situation, that each passing day, that Faith Militant is going to have a stronger and stronger stronghold on the common people, which has always been the Lannisters' weak point anyway.
It is, and it's so there is a, if you're going with a theory that the High Sparrow has been imprisoned here and these Faith Militant are doing this against his will, I don't know that it would be out of character for Game of Thrones to not show us that, because they didn't show us the High Septon before being thrown to prison.
Sure.
It just went right from like, oh, I'm so angry about this, what are you going to do about it, to conversation with the High Sparrow.
Well, and also, it could be that Cersei's just bluffing. I mean, you don't, I mean, Cersei could lie about him being in the dungeons. She could have shipped him off.
Oh, yeah, no, there's that too.
You know, she could have shipped him off some other way or across Essos where he could whore out the rest of his life.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I took it for, I took it at her word after seeing this episode.
Sure, sure.
That he was gone because he was absent. Yeah. Anyway, let's move on. Tommen goes back to his room and tells Margaery that he couldn't talk to the High Sparrow. So Margaery leaves to send word to her family. I think she's going to send word that I'm coming and then head off.
Yeah, because it sounds like she's just going to send a raven. It's like, okay, cool. But then when he goes, you're coming back, she says, I need to be with my family.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Her dad is headed to Braavos. Her brother is in a black cell somewhere.
Her family is her grandmother, right?
I don't know. Like, that's an ambiguous. I'm saying that's an ambiguous statement. She can say, I'm staying here in King's Landing because I need to support my brother, or I need to get back home to strategize with my grandma.
Okay.
I don't know how much I believe all that, but I'm just saying that
Maybe she wants her grandmother to come there.
Also, her strongest card, other than her grandmother, seems to be staying within King Tommen's good graces.
Yeah.
And flouncing out is, I don't know. I felt like she was already, I mean, because again, Tommen's a child, but I felt like she was already kind of a poor performance for his behalf. Mm-hmm. You know, like a little condescending towards him.
Yeah. If he were any more observant and slightly older, he would have noticed it.
Yeah. And again, like I feel like she needs that connection with the king to have any hope of standing against Cersei.
You're right.
But obviously she's shocked at how quickly Cersei's moved. And to be fair, this is the nuclear option Cersei's bringing out.
Oh yeah.
Like, it seems like this is a bad idea, to just be busting up all these high lords' brothels and, you know, all these very important, you know, it's always kind of been something they've hinted at, that the Littlefinger caters to the rich and powerful and their perversions.
Yeah.
Well, you're essentially declaring war on the upper class in this scene.
Yeah. One of the things I find the most interesting about this series of scenes here is how Cersei seems to think that she can do what she wants, deny that she's doing it, even though everyone and all the evidence clearly points to she is doing it. I mean, when you go and you look at the people in the streets being massacred by the Faith Militant, you see the king, the actual troops of the city looking on, not doing anything, turning their backs, all that sort of stuff. I can't help but imagine that the people see that too. The people understand that this is sanctioned by the state here.
Sure.
So, like, I had nothing to do with this.
No, it's super.
I'm not the one holding it. It doesn't, I'm not saying this is not plausible, but it irks me that something like that could happen and not have any repercussions. And I don't think it's going to have no repercussions.
Yeah.
I think eventually this two-faced sort of deal is going to turn on her.
No. Yeah, I mean, that's like real life. You know, I'm sure you can think of examples where there's been people that think they're smarter than they really are, And like, they're like, oh, wow, this passes for clever for you. And it's almost like you pity them.
She's just, she's flaunting it. Like, yeah. Like she's got everybody beat when she doesn't. She has the upper hand currently.
Yeah.
But by unveiling your motives and revealing it to people, you give them the upper hand.
And again, I just can't underline how what a terrible idea it seems to arm religious fanatics.
Yes.
As a almost separate but equal power structure to the crown.
Yeah, but one that she thinks she controls, but I doubt it.
Right. And you know, like, it'd be curious to see what Tywin and Tyrion would have to say about this as students of history.
Oh, yeah.
Because Cersei, not a student of history.
No.
Like, I'm kind of impressed that she even knew what the Faith Militant was if it happened 200 years ago.
Yeah.
But maybe you also wonder, like, is this Qyburn whispering in her ear? Like, what is his game?
Good question. I don't know.
Because
other than resurrecting the mountain, I don't know.
We say that he is her lackey, but Cersei's just so dumb and easy to manipulate in her way that you wonder what his endgame is.
No, I think I've said before in the podcast that he has some other motive.
Mm.
Whether it's directly opposed to Cersei, I don't know, or whether he just needs some sort of access to ingredients and the mountain being one of those ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure either, but we'll find out, I'm sure. Stannis' wife points out that he likes Jon a little too much. And like the son, kind of like the son that she should have given him.
Mm.
But, you know, he got a daughter instead. And she's kind of feeling shitty about that, which is interesting because given the scene later where Shireen is just, you know, bored, as mm-hmm. she says, I could definitely see her mom saying all sorts of horrible shit about
her. Oh, I mean, yeah.
To her face.
That's like, you know, when she's in that scene, she said, I know that mom wanted to leave me behind. And she's like, why do you think that? Because mm-hmm. she said that. It's like, oh,
yeah.
Stan is like, oh, for fuck's sake. No, it's a good scene. I thought it was interesting also that Stannis, when she called him a bastard and all this, he just looked at her and goes, well, that wasn't Ned Stark's way. And then she goes, I've given you nothing but weakness and deformity. And then Melisandre, because that's the thing, is like she's always been up Melisandre's ass.
Uh-huh.
Did you feel like there was a little bit of break in that alliance that she did not really like the way she swept in there and basically shit all over her anti-Shireen hate mongering and kind of turned the conversation more positive about it?
I think there's a little bit of a battle there between them, and I felt that in previous seasons.
See,
just a twinge of it.
Oh, really? Because I've always felt that she's almost insane in the way she's just like, whatever you need, Melisandre.
Sometimes she is.
My husband's penis, sure. My uncle to burn at the stake, whatever. Our Meister to save Princess Shireen's life, whatever you need. I mean,
yeah, I forget exactly what it was that made me think that, but there was a slight twinge of it. But overtly, yeah, she's very much Melisandre. Rah rah rah. But yeah, in this scene, I think you're right. There's a little bit going on there. And Melisandre asks Stannis not to leave her behind when he rides south in this scene as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he doesn't plan to.
She is putting a little bit of cold water on him, too, because he says, I need you. Ostensibly, as a continuing the conversation about, hey, don't let the Battle of the Blackwater Part 2 happen.
Mm-hmm.
But it's clearly also a sexual thing, right?
And
she says, all
so.
You need is my faith, my lord. And
yeah, I'm not sure about Stannis' sexuality. Does he have any? Like,
I don't know. You see, like I said, I feel like he's clearly got, you know, you've mentioned it, that part of, you've mentioned being annoyed that Melisandre's got him wrapped around her little finger.
Yeah.
I think not a small part. I mean, part of that is the power that he gets from her.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a part of it is that, yeah, look at Selyse, look at Melisandre.
Sure.
You know, look at the fact that, like, Melisandre seems insane too, but her insanity is like sexual blood magic. Selyse's insanity is keeping jars of deformed fetuses on display. There is a winner
all
here.
Right, sure. I'll take the former.
Yes.
So then we go to Sam and John, and he's signing a bunch of letters to the Lords of the Land, which includes Roose Bolton.
Mm.
They're requesting men for the wall. I have a little bit of a problem here.
Okay.
With him signing this letter to Roose Bolton.
Okay.
What good are men that you cannot trust when it comes down to it? I feel like whatever Roose would send, John would be looking over his shoulder saying, are these men actually here to help or here to undermine me.
There's a bit of that, but on the other hand, almost every recruit that the Black Brothers get is seen through that lens. Because no one wants to be there.
That is true.
All, you know, some type of criminal. So, you know, I mean, look at what happened to the old bear. Like, there's like a little element of that in being the Lord Commander anyway.
You're right. I think, though, that I would be worried about explicit orders from Roose to kill me if I were John.
Well, it's a mildly interesting hypothesis.
Okay. Anyway, I bet that this is a moment that the book readers have been waiting for when Melisandre turns around at the end of this scene and says, "You know nothing, Jon Snow."
That's also mildly interesting.
I can't fucking imagine that people weren't just cheering.
What did you think of that? Like, she goes in there to seduce him.
It's creepy as hell.
Why is she, and talking about the power in his blood, what do you make of all that?
Blood magic, man.
Yeah.
It's blood magic. I mean, I don't know what her ends are here, but she clearly wants to seduce John, obviously. I don't know. It's very strange, especially when paired with that, "You know nothing, Jon Snow." How does she know about that line? How does she know about Ygritte at all?
That's a very good question.
Yeah, I'm a little worried for John. And I'm super glad that he shuts her down in this scene.
Sure. I was kind of surprised. I thought that he was going to shut her down, but then the way they played it out, I was thinking like, oh man, maybe he's starting to cup her boob and he's feeling up her slick as a baby seal spot. And all we needed is Tormund in there to go har har, and we'd be off to the races. But then he brought it back.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be interesting what happens up there at the wall. That's for sure. Shireen's bored, and she's feeling bad about herself because her mother's a horrible person. And Stannis tells her the story of how she got Grayscale and how he decided not to send her away, but instead find a cure for her.
This scene is gold because...
It's touching, yeah.
You see a man like Stannis who you can tell it cost him inner reserve to show affection. And, you know, he bought this goddamn wooden doll to do something nice for his daughter and put it in a cradle, and she rubbed her cheek with it and then got infected by his grayscale. I mean, what that must have done to Stannis. Well, I mean, obviously, he combed the world for healers and
against all advice and risking a lot, the lives of many other people. So,
and a lot of this is couched in terms of like, well, you're my daughter, so I, you know, of course I'm going to take care of you. But there's also just... It's seeming a lot of affection for his daughter, something that Selyse can't bring herself to see or find in herself to feel the same way, too.
Yeah, this scene actually changes my opinion. It reinforces some of the opinions and thoughts that I had about Stannis and changes it in other ways. I didn't realize that he had this kind of softer side to him as regards his daughter.
I just thought it was a great scene, and when he says, "You do not belong across the world with the bloody stonemen. You're the Princess Shireen of House Baratheon, and you're my daughter." I got a little teared up.
Sure.
And then the awkward hug, I did same thing, and it was just it made Shireen so happy too. I think it's a much needed scene for Stannis.
And I think there's another level in which this scene works, and it shows how competent and how capable of a person Stannis is. You know, when Shireen goes over to that table and starts fucking with what is clearly a battle plan.
Sure.
And moving pieces and all that shit, he's very patient with her. He does not say, "Put that shit down," or anything like that. He waits for her to finish. He walks over, and while having a conversation and telling the story, just puts it back mindlessly. He knows the battle plan so well. Mm-hmm. He's got all this in his head. It shows that he is, you know... At the same time he's caring for his daughter, he's also got a lot of stuff going on in his head militarily. And it reinforces the point that they make about him being the best military leader
in Westeros. I was
going to
say the same thing. Like, that's a throwaway line, but that little detail all comes together. And it's just great storytelling.
I agree.
That, you know, they use this little throwaway moment in a scene that's already very effective to sell that point. And I, you know, between his interaction with Jon and his daughter there, I'm amazed at how well they're doing with kind of rehabilitating Stannis, because I think a lot of show watchers don't have much of an opinion of him one way or another. I mean, clearly you didn't. Fuck Stannis.
Yeah, I really didn't know much about him. It felt like he was being railroaded more than choosing his own destiny here.
But suddenly he's a three-dimensional character.
Yeah, in a couple of short scenes. It's pretty incredible. Anyway, Sansa's in the crypts, and she's lighting candles when Littlefinger shows up and tells her that he's going to King's Landing. And there's more to this scene, but I'm sure it will come out as we talk about it. Littlefinger here, I think it's clear now. We had an email last episode that was questioning who might know about Stannis. I think it's clear now that Littlefinger knows about Stannis. He's very clear that he's going to try and take the North, and that Sansa needs to be there when that happens.
You know what's awesome?
Whatever the outcome is.
Is we have no way of knowing how he knows that, but I don't question it in the slightest.
No.
Like, how the hell does he know about what's going on at Castle Black? But yeah, I just assume he's got probably one of the Black Brothers in his pocket that's like, you know, sending ravens on the sly or something.
Probably.
And he knows the guy, you know, obviously, you know, him being the finest military commander is just from his resume, but he knows the state of his army and his intentions to march before. I mean, it's impressive.
They're getting a lot of mileage out of the kind of character that we know Littlefinger to be.
Yeah, that's a real trick, because a lot of other shows I'd be like, how the fuck? But I just buy it because it's Littlefinger.
Yep. So Stannis wants to... Stannis somehow needs Sansa, I think, to unite the lords against the Lannisters, the Lords of the North. I think that's clear in this scene.
It would certainly be easier.
But another thing that I think the episode before this does really well is they show that the lords won't follow Stannis alone. They're actually loyal to Jon. That letter comes in. Stannis says, here, look at this.
Uh-huh.
They're loyal to you. I need you to lead these people.
Right.
Now, if he has another Stark on his side,
with the actual last
claiming
name of
loyalty,
Stark.
Yeah, that might actually work better, if not at least as well.
Sure, and clearly, you know, they've been saying that, you know, that scene where the little Mormon girl sent the response, the old lady that said, "Welcome the back to winter, welcome home."
Yeah,
the North remembers. They're all selling us on the fact that yes. It's all good that you are brothers of Ned's best friend, but the North are not going to follow anyone but their own.
Yeah.
So Sansa could be an important cog in this wheel.
I think so.
What do you think about the story time about Lyanna Stark and the tourney at Harrenhal and, you know, Rhaegar versus Selmy? There's a lot of stories of Rhaegar this episode. Selmy tells one. Littlefinger tells one. They're down here in the crypts of Winterfell. What do you make of all that?
I don't really know what to make of it.
Is this just historical context or detail or what?
So far, yeah.
All right.
I mean, I'm sure they aren't just doing it for the sake of telling us a story.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to get somewhere, but I don't know where that is yet. So I'm sure we'll find out. Bronn and Jaime land on the shore near Dorne. In Dorne, near some city.
Do you have a better handle on Littlefinger and Sansa's relationship or what he wants from her? Is he making her think that he's romantically interested in her just to draw attention away from how risky a gamble it is? Like, well, I think he's creepy, but I also believe he loves me. So I don't think it's kind of like a subconscious thing. I don't think he'd really risk my life when, you know, we talked about on the instant cast and whatever. This is a very bold plan.
It is.
It's a typically bold, and it's also not really as exactly risking Littlefinger's neck either. But, you know, he kisses her full on the lips, and then she says significantly, next time I see you, I'll be another man's wife. And her face betrays nothing.
Uh-huh.
I
don't know. Littlefinger obviously has a plan. I have a hard time buying that it's just Stannis on the throne.
Sure.
I don't know what that gains him. Mm-hmm. He was prospering within the Lannister rule. There's got to be some bigger play that he's making. He does not a guy who does small things like that.
Yeah. Hmm. All right.
I just, man, it's with Littlefinger, it could literally go anywhere.
And again, you know, his face says a lot, but I'm not sure what. Like, you know, again, Sansa, you can't read anything from. But he gives her a very interesting look when she says that, kind of like a half smile. And I don't know.
Yeah, the fact that he's playing both sides here, you know, he's talking with Roose Bolton. He's got Stannis on the mind and trying to actively help him.
But I also believe that he's possibly in love with Sansa just from a reliving the glory days of Kat standpoint.
Yeah. There's that element too.
So, yeah.
I don't know. There's some twisted thing going on in his head, but I don't know what it is yet.
Right on. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
For Prestige, me and Aaron are still extending our Shogun Afterglow with part three of our discussion of the 1980s TV miniseries. Last week absolutely shocked our sensibilities with Lord Torinaga doing the tango. What delights and horrors will await us this week?
Then for Pulp, this Friday, join us for our latest prep session for House of the Dragon Season 2 as we take another look at the key differences between the text of Fire and Blood and the on-screen action for Season 1, and what they mean for the characters, story, and setting. Get your Valyrian steel sharpened for the new season.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Madman and father of Mad Max, George Miller, is back with another apocalyptic tale from the Australian wastelands.
This time, we're getting a prequel featuring the origin story of Charlize Theron's character, Furiosa, starring the Queen's Gambit's Anya Taylor-Joy in the title role and the mighty Thor, Chris Hemsworth, as the warlord, Dr. Dementis. Furiosa promises more high-octane, slightly radioactive action and fun.
Furiosa drives into theaters on May 24th, and we'll have our spoiler-free thoughts and impressions of the film, as well as a discussion of trailers and upcoming movies for everyone. But if you want to ride with us the full length of the podcast on the eternal highways of Valhalla, shiny and chrome, you're going to have to be a club member.
Join today at support.baldmove.com. Get our full discussion of Furiosa and many more first-run films, plus tons of other bonus podcasts and ad-free feeds.
Support.baldmove.com.
So Bronn and Jamie land on the shore in Dorne, and they talk about how they want to die. Then they head toward the city, but a bunch of guards find them. Bronn kills three of them. Jamie kills the other one.
What do you think of the smash cut to Bronn looking like he's going to murder Jamie?
And looking then he's like
just,
he's going to
he's just oh, with killing the snake. Breakfast. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. I didn't think anything of it other than a gag.
Okay. You didn't get your blood pumping a little bit?
No, not okay. Really.
Also,
I don't know what reason he would have to kill Jamie.
Bronn,
if he wants any kind of payout.
Bronn literally cooks a snake by wrapping it around a bear stick and putting it in a fire. There's mm-hmm. no skinning. There's no gutting. There's no removal of head.
Goes to town on it. Yeah.
Like, I've seen survival shows where they eat snakes, and it's a lot different than that. I don't know if the Double D's know this, but I mean, Bronn's is an animal. I'm surprised he didn't eat it raw, like Tom Hanks in the second half of...
Castaway
style.
Sure. So they talk about the ways they want to die. Bronn wants to grow old as his children squabble over his fortune, and Jamie wants to die in the arms of the woman he loves. Bronn makes a wry comment about that. You know, does that go both ways? I think Jamie's certainly questioning that at the moment, mm-hmm. and, you know, that's kind of why he's here. Mm-hmm. So good line from Bronn. And I can't tell if Bronn understands how poignant of a remark that is, or if he's just, you know, making a dry observation and it hits home with Jamie unknowingly.
I don't know, because he says when he's talking about rescuing his niece, he says your niece. Like,
yeah,
I feel like and so Tyrion certainly knew about it, mm-hmm. and we know that Bronn is Tyrion's confidant and kind of like inside man. It seems likely that Bronn knows, and it's I almost got this irritation from Bronn that like, I know, and you kind of know that I know, and you're still maintaining the facade with me, like almost like it's an insult.
So he's just going to keep dropping these hands.
I kind of feel like
until
that.
Jamie goes, like, fine, fuck it. Yes, you're right.
Right, that's what he wants. Like, I can't believe you're playing. He's, you know, it's like, well, you know, do whatever, but I feel like that this is costing a little respect in his eyes. Like, I don't know if Bronn's ever inclined to respect Jamie Lannister. But he kind of, I think he respected him as a man of action, but this is a little weak. I don't know. That's the impression I got.
You think maybe he's afraid that if he just comes out and says, like, Bronn is afraid that if he says, hey, look, I know about this, don't deny it, that Jamie will just deny it and it will go on. Jamie has to be ready to tell him, so.
Yeah, I don't know.
If they're ever going to talk about it.
I don't know.
Or does Bronn even care, really?
I think he cares, but it's to the extent of what it tells him about his relationship with Jamie.
Yeah, and probably what he can get out of it.
And, you know, again, what is, you know, he's as close to Tyrion as he was with anyone, but we saw exactly where those loyalties began and end. So I don't know. Yeah. It's not really annoyed, and it's not certainly like a feeling betrayal, but it's something that he's feeling there.
Yeah. So during this fight scene, I like that even Jaime is kind of surprised when he grabs this sword
sure.
with his steel hand.
Uh-huh.
I really like that moment. He kind of looks at it and goes, oh, that's right. Grab my sword. Mm-hmm. Kill this guy. That was cool. And I like how he can only take one guy who didn't look very slowed, I got to say, by falling off that horse. He still looked pretty badass. But the fight on the side of the dune was pretty cool.
It was pretty cool. And I thought they did a good job of showing that, like, Jaime knows how to move. Mm-hmm. Like, he seems so inept when he had the sword in his hand. But, like, when he's falling down the hill, he's fairly athletic and acrobatic about getting to his feet.
Uh-huh.
It's just he doesn't know how to fight with his offhand.
Sure. It would be super awkward.
I thought they do a lot of interesting touches with the choreography to tell us what type of fighter a person is. And I thought, you know, there's another, more good stunt work there. Selling part of a character fairly well. There's another thing. Did you think there's anything thematically interesting about Jaime saying we are afraid of sharks and the Dornishmen saying there are no sharks in Dorne? Are we supposed to take that as, you know, the things in Dorne aren't as schemey?
As they are in King's Landing? I don't know. No.
Although, again, the next scene is a literal scheme and plot against the legitimate ruler of Dorne, so maybe I'm reading too much in that, but I thought, it's like, where the fuck did that come from? Was it just a joke? Or am I digging too deep?
I don't know. Bronn looks at him, too, at the same time. Yeah, he looks back and like, he's like, I thought...
Maybe it's more like, shut the fuck up. You don't know
I've got this. You're Jaime fucking Lannister. Yes. Don't open your mouth.
You have never gone undercover in your life.
Yeah.
So, golden boy, just shut up.
That's what I felt like it was. Okay, you're showing, probably right. Showing how out of depth he was there.
Sure.
So, next scene, Ilaria recruits the Sand Snakes for her cause, which is to avenge Oberyn by killing Myrcella, it appears. She finds out that Jaime Lannister is in Dorne and realizes they need to work quickly.
What did you think of the actual reveal of the Sand Snakes?
It's cool. I like the spear through the head. Yeah. Shows that at least one of them is competent.
It seems like they're all... Well, I mean, Nim's got that whip. I mean, that's the thing. It seems like they all have their signature weapon. I think her name is...
the youngest? I don't know.
I think her name is Tyrina or something like that.
Okay.
Or Tyrina.
She's actually the daughter of Ilaria, right?
She's the one that comes up and hugs. Yeah.
And these, says mama.
These two older ones are not, I don't believe.
They're just Oberyn's daughters.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and she's got the double daggers. So it looks like you've got, you know, they all got their, like, little weapon, and I saw that there, it seems like a little dissatisfaction about how Fox Force 5 these girls turned out to be, like, you know, Barra's got the chest armor and the spear, and this other girl's an expert at the whip, and it's kind of like a little jokey. I didn't get that. I thought they were cool.
Yeah, I didn't see them also, as very jokey.
I don't know what books they're reading, because this is kind of like straight out of their characterization from the books too.
I felt like it was a good touch to have somebody working with the spear because, you know, Oberyn fought with that spear.
Somebody.
Yeah. And it seems like maybe she was the most on board with this war period.
Yeah.
The other girls were kind of quiet and not reluctant to start this war, but she seemed really gung-ho.
Yeah.
And she tells a big flowery story about
that
it.
Big story about the gods let us choose our weapons, tears or spears, which sounds like a throwback 80s cover band.
Yep.
But it's also great because this show's been very good about showing us the strength and weaknesses of both approaches. Like Brienne and this Obara can be very stereotypically manly and masculine in their war efforts. And then you've got Marjorie and Sansa that are better at playing the other side, the other feminine side of the game. And then you've got people like Dany who seem to be very able to fuse both of those approaches together.
Mm-hmm.
So I liked it as a mission statement for the show, and just as an introduction, the Tears of Spears speech was pretty good.
Okay.
And it's also a very badass Oberyn thing to say, just to ride up and like throw a spear at young girls and be like, you can cry like your mother, you can ride with me.
Sure. Tyrion annoys Jorah until he takes the gag off of him. They're out in a boat. On their way to Meereen, and he deduces exactly who Jorah is and what he's doing, and he finds the whole thing kind of funny. Jorah doesn't find it nearly as funny.
Can I ask you what Tyrion was trying to sing at him? Because it's got to be either the Lannister theme or the Bear and the Maiden Fair. I couldn't match it either. But he was clearly trying to sing at him to something to annoy him.
Yeah, he's just annoying him until he took I don't know, man. He should have got a backhand before he took the gag off, frankly. Like
a warning backhand?
What good do you think taking a gag off of Tyrion is going to do for you?
To be fair,
Jorah it'll get him to stop humming, but it will not get him to stop annoying you.
Sure. I don't know. I mean, I guess Jorah doesn't know Tyrion like we do.
I guess so. I do find it slightly menacing where he's talking about, is she going to execute me and forgive you? Or I think the opposite is just as likely. That's a little scary for Jorah.
Man, it seems like neither one of them contemplate the idea that maybe she'll be like, why not both?
Uh-huh.
Either to let them live or a double execution.
Sure.
But
good point.
It's a good scene. And again, I like seeing Tyrion kind of Sherlock the whole situation.
Yeah. So Ser Barristan tells Dany that her brother used to basically busk for fun. He'd go out in the streets and he would sing and people would throw money. And then he'd take that money and sometimes donate it, sometimes use it to get drunk.
Got a dollar? Got a dollar?
So what songs do the Targaryens sing? Are they the same?
It's the same, yeah. It's
the Bear and the Maiden
the
Fair.
The Reigns of Castamere or the Bear and Maiden Fair. There's only two. It's kind of like Lego Movie. Everything's awesome. That's what everybody enjoys.
Dany enjoys this story, at least. And then Daario comes in and says, "Hey, Hisdar is waiting for you, along with like 50 or 100 other people." We get a really awesome view from the pyramid too.
Yeah,
in this scene. I was kind of blown away by that.
Yeah, that's a big ass pyramid. Like you were up there.
How long does it take you to climb to the top of that pyramid every single fucking day if you're Dany?
I don't know. I feel like it's like she gets a line of Unsullied and it's like a bucket brigade. They just pass her ass from hand to hand and she just crowd surfs up the stairs.
It's like being carried through the streets of King's Landing.
Indeed.
Okay.
But it's got to be hell on Barristan.
I bet. Yeah, his 60-year-old knees.
It'd be like taking the stairs on the Empire State Building.
Mm-hmm. All the time. Hisdar in the throne room asks Dany once again to reopen the fighting pits while the Sons of the Harpy start killing people in the streets.
It's fighting season.
Let's get a montage there. And some of the Unsullied, including Grey Worm, are lured into a trap. And then Ser Barristan shows up, and they're able to kill all the Sons in that room, but at the possible cost of both of their lives. I would say at the end of that scene that Grey Worm looks a little bit like he's in a little bit better shape.
Mm-hmm.
Because Barristan's kind of like passed out on the floor, and Grey Worm crawls over to him, but they both look in bad shape, man.
Plus, there's this whole piece of lore in the books, and I don't know, because honestly, I was shocked at the apparent death of both of these characters. But the dovetail in yours, there's a little piece of lore in the books about how one of the things that slavers do when they castrate the boys is they don't do shit for antibacterial or any kind of cleanliness. It's like a bunch of the boys die at that phase because the infection and it all heals improperly and they die. So it's almost like a way to cull the people that can't take massive trauma and heal from it.
Okay.
So that might be something in his favor. But anyway, in both of these guys, like I was looking exactly where, because I was like, well, okay, he got stabbed in the shoulder and maybe in the gut. That last sword thrust or dagger thrust was like right at the kind of like the heart area, heart lung area. Like that's,
yeah.
And he's an old dude. It was.
Yeah, Grey Worm got it in the side. So,
yeah.
Like, I think that might be survivable.
Yeah, again, especially.
It doesn't look like it's high enough to hit his lungs.
Sure.
I don't know.
I mean, it's no joke to get stabbed in medieval times anyway.
That's true.
Like, unless it's on an arm or something you can just amputate, it could be a death sentence. But. Mm-hmm. If he goes out, at least he went out swinging, because I thought from the moment he unsheathed his sword to his dramatic entrance that it was good. And I thought the stuntman that they got looked, I tried to freeze frame a couple times and I could tell it's clearly not that guy, but they did a very good job at, selling us on it.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked like a badass. Both of them did in their own way.
I agree. I was not expecting that, but they did a good job with it.
And they left just a harvest of corpses. It's knee deep in the dead doom style in that hallway.
If they had I don't know, two guys, one other guy who could perform like Grey Worm, they wouldn't have needed Barristan. Sure. Like, the other Unsullied died so quickly. And Grey Worm took on like seven or eight of these guys.
I kind of feel like they did wharf the Unsullied a little bit. Like, they had an overall. Yeah. You could have sold that scene where they just get overwhelmed because, you know, they're great fighters, but they're just, you know, first of all, their specialty is like phalanx style fighting.
Yeah.
And again, you know, like I said in the previous episode, this is what happens when you ask a military unit to basically police the streets. They get ambushed and picked off. But you could have sold that as just an overwhelming force wearing them down, which they kind of did with Grey Worm, but I feel like they diminished the reputation of the Unsullied a little bit the other way.
Yeah, a slight bit. I don't know.
But what does Dany do? Like, she had them out patrolling the streets just to maintain order, and now the Sons of Harpies are showing that they can match that force as well. And also, this dry-eyed whore, I am over this dry-eyed whore. She is a killer.
She is. She needs to be got.
Yeah.
I don't know what you do.
What the hell? I would love to know.
You unleash Dario. You fucking unleash Dario is what you do.
You get Dario and the Second Son.
Fuck the Unsullied. They know nothing.
To ninja up and go after these guys.
Yes, you do.
You need a counter-terrorist force.
You do. You do. And that's Dario.
Yep. Seems like it. It seems like it. But yeah, I would love to know the story of this dry-eyed prostitute because... Mm-hmm. Why is she so angry with Dany? Do you think she's actually a like you're going to find out that she's some noble woman
who infiltrated the ranks,
who got like kind of like a mirror of that mad guy in the first season that was all pissed with Dany because I'm glad you saved me from being raped, but I was being raped by your dudes,
yeah,
and my whole town just got sacked. Maybe she's a noble woman that got roughed up in the mayhem and she's got a personal grudge, because it seems like I don't understand why any of these former slaves would side with the masters.
And yeah,
I don't buy that these are all noblemen either, doing all this killing.
Who would they be if they weren't?
I'm just saying, like, how
former slave owners.
Well, maybe the only thing I can think of is like they're part of the pit fighters, like they're the they're essentially out of work pit fighters that are pissed that they're not able to start their fighting season, and that would explain their fighting skills.
Okay.
Because
I can also imagine that they're former military for this city. I imagine they had to have some kind of military representation here.
Right.
When Dany rolls up, that is made mention of not at all.
Right.
It seems to be that the show wants us to think there are former slave owners and former slaves, and that's it.
Yeah.
But how do you hold your city if that's the case?
Yeah, that's
and
good.
We know that they sent out their hero.
Sure.
I mean, maybe he was a pit fighter.
Yeah.
But it seems like that there could be militants, former militants running around here.
Yeah. But I would love to know more about their motivations, because it is a little puzzling right now about why they're getting the assistance that they're getting.
Maybe they're getting paid. Maybe the slave owners are paying the military, the former military guys. Because, you know, I mean, Hizdar's talking about, it wasn't Hizdar, it was the other guy who's talking about, you know, who are the people still living in the pyramids?
Sure.
Who are the people with all the money getting buried in the temples? Yeah. Those are still the former slave owners.
Right. And we know that there is tons of sellswords over in Essos.
Yeah.
You know, the Second Sons are one of them. They've made mention of others, but yeah. So they're for hire for this very reason.
Yeah, definitely. And that's it for the episode. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
I don't think so. I think we're ready for some feedback.
All right, let's do it.
First one up, Ivan from Winnipeg. You've mentioned twice this season when talking about Barristan Selmy and his confrontation with the Kingsguard in season one, and how he'd said he'd cut through them like so much butter. The actual line is, "Even now I could cut through the five of you like carving a cake." The only reason I mention is this, because you've said it twice now, and it's obvious you hold yourselves to a very high standard when it comes to accuracy of your podcasting. That's obvious? Have we been setting people up for failure, disappointment, and contempt?
Yeah, for seasons now.
Because it's such a fucking badass line. I haven't read the books, though, so perhaps he likens the guards to butter rather than cake in the books. Well, Ivan, that's what I thought, too. But then I went and reread the books, and I found that I had transmogrified the line in a way that only I can do. And I thought this would be a good time to drop a line for our sponsor, Audible, where you can get a free copy of one of their Audible books on audiblepodcast.com/GOT. And, you know, as I did last week, I'm going to play a little clip from the book, this one, A Game of Thrones, where we talk about the passage in question. So let's play the tape here, Jim, and see where I got it wrong.
Finally, he drew his sword. Sansa heard someone gasp. Ser Boros and Ser Meriyn moved forward to confront him, but Ser Barristan froze them in place with a look that dripped contempt.
Have no fear, sirs. Your king is safe. No thanks to you. Even now, I could cut through the five of you as easy as a dagger cuts cheese. If you would serve under the Kingslayer, not a one of you is fit to wear the white.
He flung his sword at the foot of the Iron Throne.
Here, boy, melt it down and add it to the others if you like. It will do you more good than the swords in the hands of these five.
So it's actually a dagger through cheese.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how I combined cake and cheese and got butter.
Yeah.
Maybe it's buttercream icing.
On top of the cheesecake?
On top of the cheesecake. There you go! This is why I love you, Jim. You're able to make sense of my madness. But Audible has over 180,000 spoken word titles, and they're unabridged. In fact, the entire Game of Thrones series, as you know it as a show watcher, or as book readers would insist it's called A Song of Ice and Fire,
mm-hmm.
by George Martin, they're all there in their entirety, all unabridged, all read by the very lovely Roy Dotrice. And I can't recommend them highly enough. And they got the WhisperSync technology. The way I was able to find that so quickly is I searched for it in my copy of the Kindle book.
Mm-hmm.
I bookmarked it. I opened up the audiobook reader, selected the bookmark. Boom, it read it to me right away. It's really, really awesome if you have both services. And by the way, you don't need a Kindle. If you got a modern smartphone, you have a Kindle device.
Yeah.
Because Windows phones, Android phones, iOS phones, they all have the application.
Even computers,
especially yeah. computers, because it's all browser-based there.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually using a browser-based client to play that clip. If they would like to find out how to get a free trial and a free audiobook, how do they do that, Jim?
You just go to audiblepodcast.com/GOT.
There you go.
You can sign up, get a free book, get a free trial, all that good stuff.
Let's get back to the email, to the feedback, rather. Inver M said, in no spoiler section of the forum, someone brought up Ollie being around important meetings. Was not a good move from John's part, given Ollie's hatred for the wildlings, specifically the Thins. I felt the same way about Danny pillow-talking Dario in the premiere episode. I mean, Dario is a fucking sellsword. What's stopping him from switching allegiances if he could tap another hotter piece and sell her out now that he's confided, or she's confided her weaknesses to him? I'm very wary of Dario. Also in A House of Black and White, something that went unnoticed was Dario's remark to that Lorax dude. Not sure if you touched on it, but when his Dario tells Dany she should have listened to him and executed the slave in private or on the pyramid, to which Dario replies, that's what I keep telling her to do with you. What do you make of that? I mean, his Dario is a little too perfect and obedient, but he hasn't given me a reason to be suspicious of him. And at this point, I'm more concerned about Dario. What do you think about this sellsword Dario, Jim? Can he be trusted? Is he true blue for Danny?
Is he leading the Sons of the Harpy? Is that what you're asking me?
That's mildly interesting. And no, I wasn't. But now I am.
Okay.
Is he, in fact, the secret commander? That explains why he knew exactly where in that wall to look.
It does. And, you know, you have to break a few eggs to make an omelet, right?
You do.
So,
a few dragon eggs.
Yeah, maybe Dario's leading it all. No, I thought it was that line was a one-off joke to his Dar.
Just need, because he's like a Han Solo smartass. He's got to shine on his rivals.
But I don't know. So he's professed his love for Danny and all that stuff, and I buy that. So I don't know if he would switch allegiances or what would cause that or anything like that. But yeah, he is a sellsword.
All right. Moving on to Seth L., what's the percentage chance that Sansa marries Ramsay and pulls a Gone Girl on him on her wedding night? How awesome would that be? Have you seen the movie Gone Girl?
I don't get that reference.
You certainly haven't read the books.
Definitely not.
Okay. So Gone Girl is about a woman who sets out to just systematically destroy her husband and frame him for murder. And she ends up murdering a lot of dudes on the way. Spoiler alert. if you haven't seen this year-old movie by now and three-year-old book. So it's essentially, is Sansa going to, you know, throw her own red wedding?
Kill Ramsay at their own wedding? I don't know. It really depends on what happens with Stannis, right? She might not need to.
Mm-hmm.
If Stannis can't, quote-unquote, save her from the Boltons, then, yeah, I could definitely see Sansa getting into something where, Sansa, she takes matters into her own hands.
Sansa's ready right now to do something like that, or do you think she needs
maybe
a...
she might think she is. Like, because she's been hanging around Littlefinger so long, she's like, sure. Yeah, I can scheme with the best of them.
Yeah. She's had scheming training wheels this whole time at a form of Littlefinger.
Yeah.
I wonder if she would be ready for something like that, or does she need some kind of intermediate step, and what might that step be?
I don't know what the step is, but I agree that she does need something to bridge that gap.
Yeah.
To make her an actual threat.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for podcasts that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
All right, moving on to Jared G. In the feedback for High Sparrow, a listener said that back in Season 2, Renly did not know who Brienne was when she fought a fight with Loras, and that was the first time they had met. This would seem to contradict Brienne's story about the ball when Renly was nice to her. This is not how the scene went down, however. Everyone else was surprised that she was a woman except for Renly. When she takes off her helmet, revealing she is a woman, everyone gasps, but not Renly. He knows exactly who it is, and he says, "You are all your father promised on and more, my lady," and knows her name without asking her. Just wanted to say so that no one was misinformed and think that the whole story of the ball was a giant continuity error.
Okay.
Yeah, like I said, my memory of the Season 2 thing was kind of weak on the spur of the moment, so thanks for setting it straight there, Jared.
Yeah.
I think it worked cool. Either way. It worked as him not paying her as much attention as a life-altering event was for her, but yeah, I also like the fact that, because you're right, Brienne is kind of unforgettable.
It seems like it.
She's not your average, just mousy waif, wallflower at a dance, you know? Mm-hmm. Great lumbering beast and all. Rob writes us, wants us to discuss Littlefinger saying how rare it is that he doesn't know much about a lord, referring to Ramsay Bolton. Mm-hmm. He begins, first off, is he lying? And if so, is he intentionally putting Sansa in peril? If not, wouldn't he have done more homework? I mean, maybe everyone doesn't know about Reek, but come on, he flays someone every third episode. What do you think?
Good question. I don't think he'd lie to Sansa. Not about that, anyway.
Yeah.
I think maybe he would for the greater good, but I don't see that as being, you know, the greater good as far as Littlefinger's concerned. Why he wouldn't have information about Ramsay is questionable. I mean, he's been around for a long time. Certainly people know that this is Roose's bastard, right?
I was thinking about that. Like, the Starks are like the Lord Paramounts in the North. They're like the wardens. They're the masters. But then the Boltons are the tier right below them.
Mm-hmm.
So is it reasonable to assume that Littlefinger would not know about the only son, albeit a bastard, of the Boltons in the North? That doesn't seem like it would be something that would escape his notice.
I think you're right.
Now, you have to question how well Roose was able to suppress knowledge of his sons, because it's clearly is not something he's proud of.
Yeah.
Or maybe, you know, it is certainly carrying on the Bolton tradition, but he doesn't see it as real politic. He doesn't see it as very strategically sound. So you have to question, could Roose suppress that information? Is Roose's ability to keep stuff covered up equal to Littlefinger's ability to find stuff out? And after the last few episodes, I kind of think, yeah, I could buy that.
Possibly. I don't know. Everybody seems to know about Jon Snow, but Jon Snow was just totally out in the open, right?
Like, sure. I mean,
he's walking around.
He lived Winterfell, in Winterfell.
Just hanging out. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I feel like it just doesn't jive. It doesn't fit with the idea that Littlefinger is kind of all-knowing in this world.
So assuming, let's play the other side. Let's go internet advocate here. If he does know about Ramsay and is just playing possum, to what end? Is he deliberately putting Sansa at risk? Does that jive with how much it seems like he cares about?
It doesn't.
If not Sansa as a person, Sansa as an object to be possessed as a consolation prize for not getting cat all those years ago.
That or possibly a pawn on his board. I think he's grooming Sansa for something.
Sure.
Beyond just, you know, I want a Catelyn replacement.
Grooming, that's an interesting choice in this case. On the same subject, Rob continues, you mentioned if anyone knows about Stannis' whereabouts, it'd be Littlefinger. So is it possible he knew to drop Sansa at the last second and get away if Stannis will truly be there in a fortnight? Wouldn't Sansa be scared or mad that Uncle Baelish won't stay through the wedding? He may have had to leave in a hurry anyway if immediately means Cersei needs him now at King's Landing. Otherwise, we should expect a turbo wedding at Winterfell? In any case, my unsullied opinion is his comment about the last time the Winterfell and Vale paired up, they toppled a dynasty, to mean that he, as the Vale and Starks, possibly Sansa, not Bolton, led overthrow.
Okay.
I might not have read all that correctly, but I think he's saying that to Roose, but he's implying that him and Sansa Stark is the real alliance he's talking about. Mm-hmm. I buy that.
Sure. Yeah, if he's setting up her up as the Warden of the North or the Winterfell Captain or the fucking, I don't know what the title would be, but yeah, they could definitely join forces later on. I mean, she doesn't have any power right now, but sure, she will.
And obviously his turbo wedding at Winterfell came before he saw this episode, so interesting stuff to think about. Rachel L. said, I'm assuming that people have already pointed this out, but just in case there are all those people out there who like the idea of Brienne and Pod hooking up, I thought I'd better point out a major reason why Brienne and Pod developing a sexual relationship would be a terrible idea.
Okay.
Pregnancy. Westeros is a world where the pill, IUDs, and other convenient prophylactic measures like moon tea aren't available. That's actually a real thing
moon
in the books.
Moon tea?
Yeah. Yeah.
The fuck is that? Birth control?
It's a tea that's like an abortificant. It's essentially like Plan B of Westeros.
Is this invented by Melisandre?
I do believe
dragon magic stuff.
I think it's there's several herbal remedies throughout the ages that have been advertised to do that thing.
Yeah.
So, abortion is not something invented in the 20th century. If people were were thinking,
it's been improved in the 20th century.
Sure. Much safer. Anyway, these aren't available from a neighborhood pharmacist. From Brienne's stance, a pregnancy would be a complete disaster. Her gift is her ability as a warrior. Given the high risk of pre-20th century childbirth, there's a high risk she could die from complications. Best case scenario for what? She has a healthy child and now has someplace... Wait, she has a healthy child and has to now somehow provide for another person? It would mean the end of her career as a warrior. All true.
Yeah, I think so.
Also, the power dynamic of the relationship as knight and squire would be irrevocably altered and would dump things back into a more standard male-female Westerosi trope, which would kind of suck. I like that these two are friends and are developing a great friendship that goes against every norm of social convention, but as friends, they have a lot to offer each other. Podrick is more observant and socially able than he often seems, and his King Landing's knowledge could help Brienne navigate or at least dodge politics a bit better. I'm hoping for them to become BFFs and a really solid team.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't need a romantic relationship.
Yeah, I am definitely not shipping Pod and Brienne, but that's an excellent reason for them not to, for Pod not to develop or demonstrate his skills in that area.
Yeah.
Michael K. said, on rewatching, I think Littlefinger identifies that he knows that Arya is still alive. He says to Sansa, he says that Sansa at Moat Cailin, you're Sansa Stark, eldest surviving child of Ned and Catelyn Stark. If he thought that everyone else was dead, he surely would have only said, or surely would have said only and not eldest. Doubtful that he has info on Bran or Rickon, as that was barely known, and he may have seen Arya Harrenhal. Either writing here was poor or intentional. Which do you think?
I don't know, man. I don't know. Like, you can get caught up in semantics,
right?
A little bit.
And
too
the argument
much,
is, and like, if this is real life, you couldn't make this argument. But since this is scripted drama, it is a little bit stronger to say.
Yes,
I think it's fair to say that you can infer things. Now, you might not always be right in your inference, because sometimes, honestly, the viewers are more clever than the show writers, because we outnumber them like a million to one.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I don't know. What would be the implications of him knowing about Arya still being alive? I honestly don't know. Because she is younger than Sansa, so there is no hereditary heirs stuff going on here.
No, but I mean, I guess he doesn't know about Bran, right?
It's up in the air whether he does or not. And again, she would still be the youngest, Sans would still be older. So,
but doesn't all of the power and the inheritance and stuff usually fall to the male child, like the eldest male child?
Oh, that's a good point. If there's any male heirs, it probably. I mean, again, medieval lineage is kind of hard to understand, and it was different from country to country.
Okay.
But I do believe that's how it worked. Yeah. And in fact, it might even work through like your brother's sons. Like, so your cousin, you know, if you're a daughter, a cousin might jump in front of you. I mean, obviously Jon Snow's not in that running, cause he's a bastard, and really Rob's the only one older. So we know Rob's dead. That's a true statement.
I don't know how inheritance works, but
yeah, I know someone set me straight like 2 seasons ago in a feedback, and it was a really well-researched missive, but I can't remember. It just doesn't come up that often, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, Grant Y says, I don't think that Jon Snow is Ned Stark's bastard child. I think that he is the love child of Rhaegar Targaryen and Lyanna Stark, and from the latest episode, it's given me enough fuel to put my theory out there. From the first season, there seems to be something more to the story of Ned Stark's bastard child. Ned seems way too honorable and loyal to Catelyn to have taken on a mistress. He doesn't have any of the exuberance that Robert had when talking about his romps in a sack. Perhaps because that didn't happen? Before Ned leaves for King's Landing and Jon Snow heads for the Wall, Jon asks about his mother. Ned tells Jon that he will tell him all about his mother when he returns from King's Landing. Based on the events of this past episode, I believe that Lyanna is Jon's mother. First of all, Ser Barristan tells stories of Rhaegar giving away money to the poor, which isn't really a calling card for a rapist. I tend to think that the show is softening the perception of Rhaegar now, so that he is a more likable character when this truth is revealed. Furthermore, Sansa has a conversation with Littlefinger about her aunt, and the facial expression that Littlefinger gives when Sansa says her aunt was raped would suggest otherwise. It would make perfect sense to me why Ned would come back from war and call Jon his bastard son. Robert is now king and would be devastated to find out that his beloved Lyanna loved another, especially a Targaryen, and Robert finding out might even have put the child at risk of death. Ned protected a child by claiming it was his bastard and bearing the shame that came with it in regards to his wife. This revelation was also explained why Melisandre is so interested in Jon, a man with both Targaryen and Stark blood. How could she resist? It's interesting because Alan Sepinwall thought that the whole story of Rhaegar and Lyanna was a parable of, you know, yet again, one person's monster is another person's saint.
Okay.
And we see that time and time again, how differently people are viewed depending on the lens. And you see, you know, Dany's getting this one image of Rhaegar. Sansa has this other image of Rhaegar. Mm-hmm. You know, Littlefinger has an enigmatic look. It could be just another statement of how gray this world is.
It could be. Yeah.
Let's move on to Heath L. I was just listening to your official full cast on Game of Thrones 503 High Sparrow and was at the point where you were talking about how you guys recognize the High Sparrow himself, actor Jonathan Pryce from other works, but you were having problems placing him from where? Let me take the time to introduce you to the Game of Thrones James Bond 007 villain crossover game. It's very simple. Try to find as many ex-Bond villains as you can in Game of Thrones. Jonathan Pryce played Elliot Carver in the second Pierce Brosnan 007 movie from 1997, Tomorrow Never Dies. God damn, I feel old. He was the lead villain, a media mogul. That's almost 20 years ago,
You're right, absolutely he was, yeah.
Yeah, he was the lead villain, a media mogul, who he was essentially evil Ted Turner.
Yeah.
Who tried to start World War III between Britain and China, sell newspapers, gain broadcasting rights in China, and make money.
Yep.
Easiest one to spot, of course, is Ned Stark slash Sean Bean himself, who played Agent 006 Alec Trevelyan in Bronson's
favorite James Bond movie.
And this was exactly 20 years ago.
Yeah.
In Bronson's first movie, the 1995 GoldenEye, he was the lead villain who's actually a former agent just like Bond, but turned against Britain because he was actually an orphan of Russian descent, and he tried to rob the British banks while destroying all their technology with a wide-scale EMP blast over London. Another is Grandmaster Pycelle, actor Julian Glover, who was also the lead villain in For Your Eyes Only, one of Roger Moore's later efforts from 007 from 1981. He pretended to be an ally of the British while he was really smuggling goods throughout the Mediterranean and selling British government secrets and technologies to the Russians. He also did some work for the Nazis back in Indiana Jones days.
Oh, okay.
These are just the ones I found so far, but I have to think this is an ongoing joke at this point between the double Ds behind the scenes. How many Bond villains can we stuff in there without anyone noticing? I just assume at this point the double Ds are just massive closet Bond fans, and that when the Mountain truly gets resurrected, he will return as a resurrected Gert Frobe, and he will have Goldfinger himself back on screen telling people how much he expects them not to talk, but simply to die.
Here's what I think it is.
Yeah.
The Venn diagram, the overlapping section of the Venn diagram of people in James Bond movies and people in Game of Thrones is so huge that you're bound to get a whole bunch of those actors.
Right, right. So it's also kind of ironic because Charles Dance plays a parody of a James Bond villain in the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie Last Action Hero.
Okay, so I haven't seen that one.
I mean, yeah,
few.
The Venn diagram of British dudes who've played evil characters, because let's face it, in the last 30 years, 90% of all villains have been evil British dudes, evil German dudes, or evil Middle Eastern dudes.
Okay.
Yeah. That is 95% of all villains from American cinema in the last 30 years. So you're right. That's a pretty wide net to be cast in when you're trying to find British dudes for Game of Thrones. Buddy C, I was wondering, if Ramsay is only legitimized because of a king's edict, shouldn't it stand to reason that his legitimacy could be taken away just as simply? Once Cersei learns of Ramsay's wedding to Sansa, I don't imagine Ramsay remaining a Bolton for long, at least not in the eyes of the crown. Is this something unforeseen by Roose and Littlefinger, or am I missing something? This seems like a serious consistency problem with the double Ds creating the storyline out of whole cloth. So I did some research, and I guess the whole legitimizing bastards thing is extremely rare in Westeros. In fact, Martin has written about it and say it's so rare that there is matters of disagreement about, like, if you have an older son, it's a bastard, and then a trueborn son that's, like, second in line, and then you legitimize the older bastard. Should he get everything, or should the trueborn son get everything? Like, people disagree about that, and wars have been fought. Now, it seems like if a royal decree can legitimize a bastard, then a royal decree could illegitimize a bastard.
Yeah.
But I think what would more likely happen is that I believe a king can also strip by royal decree a man of lands and titles.
Okay.
So instead of actually saying you're no longer that guy's son, which is kind of ridiculous, he would just strip him of his heraldry and his family name, or not his family name, but of his titles and honors and lands, which
makes
sense. That's all the good stuff about being
What good is a name without any of the benefits that go along with it?
Exactly. But if anyone knows any, like I said, I spent about 30 minutes researching this and I couldn't come up with anything conclusive. Could not find a single instance of a royal decree dissolving someone's legitimacy. So if you guys know otherwise, send it in to GameOfThrones@baldmove.com. Barrett R., what kind of reviews does Littlefinger's brothel have on Yelp? I feel like 9 out of 10 times we go there, something horrible is happening, which is bad enough, making the setting for all things murder, where there are endless possibilities. But at this point, what reasonable person would patron Littlefinger's? If it's not baby murder, it's Lannisters being maimed by Dornishmen. In the space of back-to-back episodes, we've had the High Septon getting his junk whipped, followed by another sparrow-led attack on who knows who. I'm sure I'm forgetting some other ones, but Jesus, I think the double Ds are unwittingly pressing their luck here. Surely word has gotten out that this brothel may not be the best place for those seeking discretion. just seems lazy to me to keep us going back there where it serves little purpose for the plot.
Well, it doesn't serve much purpose for Littlefinger's plot, but...
Zero stars, got junk whipped, would not patron eyes again.
Yeah, paraded through the streets, nude.
Ended up in the black cells, would not recommend.
Yeah, had to have my hand amputated. Do not repeat.
Girl's face entirely covered by hair.
I'm wondering if that's going to be any kind of focus in the plot coming up. When Littlefinger comes back, is he going to try and set his business straight? Because it's obviously been damaged, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of a plot point, that Littlefinger's been gone now, what, two seasons?
Yeah.
So his power is really waning in King's Landing. He's not on a small council anymore. He's not personally there to supervise and to keep everything in line. It's just Oliver trying to hold it together. Oliver is not a Littlefinger.
No. And so when Littlefinger gets back, I wonder if he'll be displeased with how it's been run.
Yeah. I am very curious to see what kind of confrontation happens between him and Cersei, what his business with Cersei is, or actually what her business with him is. Uh-huh. A lot of interesting angles there. Mildly interesting angles. Christina T has a micro theory. I have a quick thought about Meryn Trant and the Tyrell storyline. What if all of this is working to move Arya's plot along? I think I remember her repeating Trant's name on her list in her prayer, and since he's headed to Braavos, there's a possibility that she could see him and run into him. If that were to happen, she would have to decide pretty quick if she's going to become a faceless man or cling to Arya Stark. She's already on the fence about truly committing to the gig based on her saving Needle, and this might push her to decide. What do you think? She's walking down the alley. She sees the man that killed her mentor. Is that a mildly interesting plot point for you, Jim?
I think so.
Yeah?
Yeah, she would have to at least make a decision there, you know?
Why would the faceless man care?
I don't know. If the Karate Kid were to go off and sign himself up for another tournament while Mr. Miyagi's training him...
Yeah.
I don't think Mr. Miyagi would like that. I think, you know, they want a certain level of focus, those wise old masters.
Sure.
So I can't imagine that you can just stop your training in the middle to go kill a bunch of people and not have that be a setback in your training.
All right. Interesting. Mildly interesting. Let's move on to Jasmine G. I really enjoyed the last scene of the episode. If Grey Worm and Barristan are indeed dead, it was an epic send-off for them both. It opens the way for Tyrion and Jorah and underlies the fact that Dany doesn't really have a hold on her city. There's just one thing that keeps me from loving it. Why are the Unsullied so easy to defeat? When the Unsullied were introduced to us, they were the ultimate of badasses.
Because they have like 4 pounds of muscle total on their bodies. That's why.
Dany was promised that an army of 8,000 Unsullied could take an army many times its size. These are men raised from childhood to be weapons of war. I can barely buy that the Unsullied would waltz straight into an obvious ambush on account of the whole no fear issue that pointed out to us a couple episodes ago. What I don't buy is that the Sons of Anarchy take them and sell me down. I'd have to rewatch the scene, but it looked like they were only outnumbered perhaps 3-1, in which case I expect the Unsullied to win. Plus, if I'm not mistaken, the Sons of Harpy aren't even necessarily trained fighters. Mm-hmm. Could have sworn I saw a couple of chubby dudes there in those masks. I just can't co-sign on the way the battle turned out.
Yeah, you know, I've always had a problem with how the Unsullied look. They don't look like warriors. They look like dudes who've been dressed up in armor. Mm-hmm. And their reputation has all come from, like, the threat of them. Like,
right.
the implied skills. And we see, like, their skills... are good. I mean, they take out, you know, at least 2-1 there, and especially Grey Worm. Grey Worm is killing like 10 dudes at least.
Right.
So, I mean, I know that they have skills. The Sons of the Harpy, I'm still sticking with the idea that maybe they are sellswords of some kind.
Yeah.
Because you're right, the masters would not have any training whatsoever.
Sure. They're just rich, soft, fat dudes.
Yeah. Yeah. So I can definitely see why you would be a little upset about the Unsullied not being great warriors.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I thought they mostly held their own. They got fucking overwhelmed, man. A 3-1 advantage is no joke.
Yeah.
You get surrounded by dudes, even a 3 dudes. I mean, that's why, look at Brienne, the time that she had to fight 3 guys, that was a fucking struggle, and she was way bigger than them.
And certainly better skilled. So I also think it's a point... you know, I've made the point that you don't use a peacekeep, you don't use soldiers as a peacekeeping troop. Also, soldiers that are trained in using ridiculously long spears fighting in narrow corridors.
Yeah.
It's like, I think you kind of give credit for the Sons of Harpy to pick the terrain. Like on an open field, these guys interlocking shields with those long swords, it's a bloodbath. It's a shit show. Like in the plains of Westeros, these guys could potentially dominate. Also, that was supposed to be the key to the Unsullied. It's their superior training on the battlefield that helps them overcome the massive disadvantage from having your balls cut off when you're like 5 years old. You don't grow lean muscle mass without testosterone. It doesn't happen.
Sure. Yeah.
So I like that it's realistic that these guys are kind of slender yet well trained. So I think again,
that's a good point. You get them out of their element.
Yeah.
And they're not equipped to compete with guys who are actually trained fighters and have, you know, muscle mass.
Right. Armies learn this lesson over and over again. You design a tank to fight on the plains of Europe, and then you send it into the desert, into desert towns, and suddenly it's not doing so well. It's not invincible. I think that's the Unsullied. They are not designed to be a police force in a town with small twisty corridors, and Dane's going to have to figure out something really quick to counteract this threat, because the Sons of Harpies seem very smart, very, very with a gift for tactics.
Dario will step in.
Unless he's the rat, like we just discussed.
Nah, can't imagine.
Buddy C says, Barristan the Bold, as the books tell it, is one of the greatest fighters left alive in the world. Eddard and Jaime have both said that he is the one they would never fight. So rather than showcase this, as the books do on numerous occasions, we get one fight against some faceless jerks. And for what? To save Grey Worm, the most boring and useless character put on screen since Walter from Lost? This is a shame and a travesty. Barristan deserved better. We deserve better. If in fact Barristan the Bold is dead, I go back and forth about whether this is an appropriate occasion for him to go out, because I feel like they could have milked a lot more badass out of him.
Yeah, I agree. We only got to see that one fight, but
having said that, again, him unsheathing the sword and running towards everyone else is running away and wrecking house. Pretty badass.
Yeah, it's going to
be very well done.
It's going to feel a little futile if both of them are dead. I mean, yeah, it's a cool moment, but what does it actually do other than make Danny mad?
You compare that to like the Hound saving Sansa.
He's
gone in there
that
and
was
like,
epic.
Hacked those dudes apart, and then he or Sansa died at the end. Well, I guess Sansa dying would have made it irrelevant, right?
Sure, yeah. I mean,
So, it would have been a lot more awesome if he did that defending Danny and died at her feet with everyone else dead. Or he did it to defend Grey Worm and Grey Worm. Although, again, I'm kind of with this guy. Fuck Grey Worm. He's a Grey Worm.
Yeah, I'm not that invested in Grey Worm.
It's amazing that he's actually more interesting than he is in the books. But I would much rather keep Barristan around. He's a cooler character.
And he's got better advice for her, I think.
Certainly.
You know, he's kind of a leader that she needs at this point.
Yeah.
Now that if in fact he's gone, I'm not certain of that, but if he's dead, that's going to be a huge problem for her. So, I mean, that may be the sense in which it pays off, you know?
If Grey Worm's dead, at what point do you think Dany can start having problems with her Unsullied? Because we already see that they are starting to have independent thoughts. She's encouraged that, you know. We are stuck here in this town defending people that are not our own and getting killed, and now our leader's gotten killed. What the hell are we doing here? They're going to have moment.
What else do they want to do? Like, do they want to go kill people in other places? Do they want to not be warriors? It seems like...
I don't know.
You know, their whole lives they've been warriors. That's kind of what they know.
Right.
I would expect them to want to continue to be warriors, but maybe just to have a different target.
I don't know. Maybe one of them wants to get in the pottery. Maybe one of them wants to sail a ship. Like, they haven't had... It's not like they went to career counseling and like, oh, yeah, warrior, cut my balls off. You know,
But you tend to stick with what you know for the most part. They know war.
Well, they have a midlife crisis.
There you go. They all buy Corvettes and drive off into the desert.
Corvette is a breed of horse in Westeros, just so you know. Devin H., first off, an instant take, you're saying that when Jaime said he wanted to die in the arms of a woman that he loves, he was referring to Cersei. I think there's a bit more to it than that. I think to Jamie, it's more of a general statement that he wants a woman to love and one that will let him love her. I think Jamie's undergoing some changing internal character and trying to figure out what he wants. Part of him still wants Cersei. I know what part. But part of him is realizing how ludicrous and manipulative their relationship is, and he's growing tired of it. He needs a more stable, mutually honest, mutually respectful, mutually affectionate relationship. I think this tumultuous and relational introspection and undergoing character change is hinted at by the merchant ship passing by Tarth on the way to Dorne. This is a shot that is completely out of place in the episode, if not to remind us that of Jaime and Brienne's connection. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Tarth is shown shortly before Jaime says he wants to die in the arms of a woman that he loves. Also, I hate to say this because I've grown to like Jaime, but that sounds like potential foreshadowing.
So my question would be, why is he on this mission then? Is it because he wants to actually just save Myrcella?
It is his daughter, and this is also kind of jive with his awakening, spiritual awakening or whatever. His continuing face turn.
So the theory here would be that he's not doing this for Cersei. He's in fact just doing it for himself and for Myrcella, and that he actually loves Brienne, which I'm cool with.
Yeah, no, I'm a big Jaime and Brienne fan.
I've always kind of been hoping that they would,
I
don't know, end up together, whatever that means in this universe.
Sure.
But that really changes the perspective on it.
Yeah, I mean, my take is, I think he is confused, you know.
Definitely.
You look at their arc last season, and it was two people that are aware that their status and their situation has changed, but they still want to try to recreate these patterns and others resisting or not resisting or whatever. But I never thought about the whole seeing Tarth and then saying, I want to die in the arms of a woman I love. That is very connected cinematically.
Yeah.
So
it's got to be significant.
Yeah, I'm totally on the Jaime Brienne ship. Denise T. It was painful watching Tommen get emasculated by the Sparrows. The only time I ever have wistfully wished Joffrey was still the king, because you know old Joff would have taken that "oh, the Sparrows too busy for you" bullshit for 1 second.
Joff would get out his crossbow.
Joff would have offered up a big helping of some sparrow pie. Rest in peace. Yeah, honestly, Tommen should have just cleaned house. Yes, it would have shed blood in the Great Sept of Baelor. Yes, it would have.
I was hoping he would.
It would have increased his cries of bastard and abomination amongst the little folk. But this sparrow thing is not going to be an easy to control situation.
And no,
I think he could have done it this episode. In 2 weeks' time, you know, they're going to keep carving heads, they're going to keep putting on black robes and tying chains around their chest, bandolier style, and it's going to be something that the Gold Cloaks can't handle.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if this, like, is a geometric growth situation, but there's certainly, if all you need to be a faith militant is a black robe, a hammer, and a scar on your forehead, that's not a high requirement.
No, you're right.
You can mint those things out. You can punch them out like movie tickets.
Sure. It might spread through King's Landing like a virus.
A religious virus. Joel H., the Sand Snakes, for some reason, that entire scene rubbed me the wrong way. I kept getting a Sucker Punch vibe from them. The film.
Oh, God, that's a terrible movie.
It is.
One of the worst I've ever seen.
It is, but you know what? After he said it, I'm like, oh, man, it is kind of Sucker Punchy. I like cheese in my nachos, but not in my Game of Thrones. I don't know if it's the actresses' performances, the direction, the writing, or a combination thereof, but it's not working.
Okay.
You know, the Sand Snakes are kind of cheesy in the books, in the same way that, like, Renly's Rainbow Guard, Kingsguard, was cheesy. Uh-huh. But I never noticed, and now that they're on screen, it didn't bother me the first time, but it could get a little Fox Force 5.
Yeah,
Deadly Viper Assassin Squad, you know?
I'll say I noticed it, and it felt slightly weird, but I'm okay with it.
It's weird because, like, Oberon was, you know, with his you know, flowing blouses and his flowery talk and his bisexual gangbangs. It was kind of ludicrous in King's Landing, but for some reason, him being the only one that was that over the top grounded it in a way that, like, okay, sure. You see, like, they're purporting the whole country is populated by Oberons.
Yeah.
It seems a little much.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, because his brother is very different, right?
Yeah.
So it makes me wonder if, in fact, the whole country is Oberyn's, or if it's...
But you see what I'm saying?
Much like, more split.
All that concentrated Oberyn without seeing a lot of other people. Like, we only have Oberyn's brother to counteract that. It is a little bit, too much sugar in your sweet tea kind of situation. It's making my teeth hurt.
And we become, kind of like the audience in King's Landing, where we're looking at Oberyn going, oh, this is a little ridiculous here, but whatever. Whereas you go to Dorne and you're like, you're the outsider, It puts you as an audience member on the other side of it going, guys, you're all ridiculous.
Yeah.
And everyone going, no, you are.
Yeah, right.
So it's a little fish out of water sort of thing, right?
Sure. All right. It's like going to Fremont in Seattle, and it's like, suddenly you're the only non-hipster.
You're the weirdo. Exactly.
You're the fucking weirdo. Allison D. said, hey, guys, I noticed an instant take. You were talking about three Sand Snake girls and who their mothers were. I don't know if you watch all the behind-the-scenes things on HBO after the episode, but this week is and was about the Sand Snakes scenes, and they talk about how all three girls have different mothers and distinct personalities. It's very interesting, and I'd encourage you to watch it if you haven't. That's actually super good advice. I didn't get to do it this week because of our schedule, but if you have HBO Go, in the related episode materials, they always have an inside, and it's always something really interesting about the architecture or a particular scene, and it... I mean, I guess if you're an extreme spoiler phobe, there might be something in there because the characters kind of talk about their backgrounds and their motivations and some things that might not be further developed into an episode or two. But,
How long until HBO merges HBO Go and HBO Now? Like, I think it was silly of them to make those two distinct services. Just give people access to HBO Go for a certain fee per month.
Yeah, especially since...
Branding-wise, that's silly.
Especially since I feel like they just... took the source code for HBO Go, Control-C, Control-V,
pretty much.
Compile, boom, there you go. I don't know. That is interesting.
Because now on my Apple TV, I now have an HBO Go app and an HBO Now app.
Sure.
And it's just really weird.
I think it's all about, them taking this long to get HBO Now, when obviously it's a fantastic economic idea, is all about them at the HBO headquarters. With the beans on the triple beam scale, measuring it out and like, okay.
Pleasing the masters.
When the Comcast and Time Warner revenue drops off enough that we can justify the increased revenue from that, or when it's our contracts are up and we can renegotiate, I think that's the reason it's different, is because it's a marketing thing. It is. It's not the same thing that a cable subscriber is getting. Look, it's called Now, not Go. Wouldn't you rather go than the Now? Now rhymes with cow. Do you want to be a cow? I mean, in 10 years, I suspect it'll just be HBO.com.
Yeah.
And that also is featured on Time Warner and Comcast.
Probably.
Gerard M., one thing that kind of bugs me. With all these brothel raids, when the fuck are they finally going to arrest Oliver? On a 7th raid, the 10th, 998th? Are the faith militants only after prominent people who purport to be in line with the 7? And perhaps Oliver has made no claims as such? Or should I possibly read something into his not being arrested? Maybe my early theory as to him being the key to getting to turn Marjorie is still in play. Hard to think she'd be seduced while she's still steaming about Loras at this point, though. I think his larger point of, is Oliver dodging all this attention? Like, the worst he's gotten is a fat lip in all these raids, even though he is the male whore meister.
Mm-hmm.
Should we read something into that, Jim?
I think you probably should in Game of Thrones. That's always a smart move.
Why not? It's fun.
Yeah.
I got a tinfoil hat on.
It could be as simple as... the story calls for someone to fill in Littlefinger on what's been going on, and that's kind of been, his guy left in charge, the sidekick, the whatever, for Littlefinger. But I doubt it. Mm. There's got to be something more there. I'm just not sure what it is yet.
All right. Danny H. says, after watching Thrones for 5 seasons, I need to ask an important question. Has anyone else noticed that Aiden Gillian, a.k.a. Littlefinger, is a terrible actor? I have no idea what accent he's attempting, and his performance is hammy as hell. He's terrible in the 2 minutes of The Dark Knight Rises he's in, as well as other movies. I'll admit he's average in The Wire, but nothing compared to the other acting talent on the show. Is it just me who sees this? Clearly HBO doesn't.
I don't know. I like the change from... Yeah. I saw him in The Wire, then I saw him in this, and I was like, wow, those are vastly different characters, right?
Yeah.
So I thought he was actually pretty good. The accent, yeah, it's ridiculous. No one has that accent in this world except for him.
Well, he's Irish. Is that his natural accent?
Ooh, I doubt it. Because it's a weird accent, man.
I know that they try to kind of keep like the guys in the north having like a northern type British accent, and people in the south having a more like King's Landing is more of a London, you know, accent. So I don't know if that means like the Vale is kind of Irish. I don't know, but it is an odd one. But I guess why would he have a terrible Irish accent? He's an Irishman.
Yeah, maybe he's been in Hollywood too long.
Is it just the inflection he puts on the lines that makes it seem odd to us, or?
I think he's doing another accent. I don't think that's his real accent, but I'm not sure of it.
Yeah, I've never heard an interview. Maybe I need to look up an interview of just him talking to King's English. But I don't think he's terrible, though. Nope. I never thought he's terrible.
I like him.
All right. His other point, my bald and chain fun is now over. Tyrion has been kidnapped by Mormont, and we've entered the second terrible season where the network has demanded Tyrion be married to a handsomer, more surly man with a full head of hair. God damn the networks. That's his, you know, the Tyrion Varys, bald and chain, two gay lovers living and having adventures.
No.
Yeah, he talked about this. It's a TV show he came up with.
Oh my God. Okay. Yeah.
So the second season.
What does he call this one?
They wrote out Varys. I don't know. I'd say Bear and Jane. Oh no.
That's a good one.
Bear love.
Good one for Jorah, yeah.
Bear, the little bear, I don't know. I'm not good with the non-offensive
I'm sure
gay
he'll come up
comedy
with something.
Nicknames, honestly.
He'll come up with something and send it to us next week, I'm sure.
All right. There you go, Danny. It's all on you. Mark from Omaha said, I haven't thought of Varys being allied with Jorah and the kidnapping of Tyrion until it was brought up in instant cast. It makes a lot of sense in retrospect, though. Varys is not getting anywhere near Tyrion... or is not getting anywhere with getting Tyrion to sober up. By having Jorah kidnapping Varys was getting him off the bottle cold turkey. He's also getting Tyrion to do what he does best, think. He was able to deduce Jorah's identity from the clues before him. He should be in fine form by the time he lands in Meereen.
That's a fair point. This, like I said, it may be a very curvy road to Meereen. I kind of threw that out there as a joke. Like, maybe this is part of his plan, but maybe...
I mean, Varys is a master manipulator. This is all mildly interesting. And the ball and chain, he just wasn't being taken serious.
He puts up such a fight, though, when Tyrion wants to get out. I don't know, man. I mean, does he just suspect that when they get to Volantis, Tyrion will have had enough and demand to get out and, like, he'll want to go to the brothels? That he can assume fairly. But, like...
You'd have to assume.
There's so many things that have to fall into place.
Varys still knows where Jorah is after he turned traitor against the legitimate king and started supporting Daenerys. You'd have to assume
is Jorah in on it.
He could get a raven off to Jorah, even though he's not at a castle, or you know, it's like I don't think you can just send a raven to some dude in Volantis and the raven's gonna be like, ha ha, there he is. I mean, you can send a raven to a tower in some keep. Like one of the 20, 30 places in the Westeros that people give a shit about, but just sending them anywhere is I don't know.
Seems like there's a lot that has to just go perfectly for that plan to work.
Yeah.
I don't know.
All right. Just got, I think, two or three emails left. Gary L. says, Game of Thrones has had some pretty great pairings of characters. Arya and the Hound, Brienne the Pod, to name just a few. And this season we've had Jaime and Bronn and Tyrion with Varys. I want to know what you guys think of the recent pairing of Tyrion and Jorah. It seems like the writers could really mine a lot of material from this pairing. Both men are sons of a deceased famous father and members of a well-known house who were both exiled from their homes for their own doing and are in love with two women who hate and despise them. Granted, one's a prostitute and the other's a queen, but this makes the scene in the brothel last episode the somewhat bizarre when we have both men in the presence of a cosplaying Daenerys prostitute. Is this the show's twisted way of trying to draw similarities between the two women and their relationship to Jorah and Tyrion? Is this excellent writing or coincidence? Are you guys excited for this pairing, and do you think you might like it more than the Tyrion and Varys pairing?
I just don't think this pairing is going to last very long.
Mm.
You know, I don't I don't know, unless they do another episode on a boat, but...
Motherfucker.
I can't imagine that they're not just going to get to Marine at this point, and he's going to try and hand him over to Danny.
Yeah, it seems like an in-game. That's a mildly interesting point. You go to Marine, and... I mean, I guess if Grey Worm and Barristan are both dead, then maybe there's room for both, but it seems unlikely that Danny would keep both of them. It seems like she'd execute them both or execute one or the other.
Okay.
But I do like the parallels of their structure here, and also having the Daenerys prostitute is a very interesting way to tie their backstories together.
Yeah.
In a way that I didn't suspect. So good on you for that, Gary. Moving on, Ryan R.D. said, I was just thinking a bit about Jaime's newfound sense of paternal responsibility. I think there's a close tie-in with the death of his father. My first reaction to Jaime's actions post Tywin's death made me think he didn't give a flying flea about his dad. But you have to think that no matter who you are, if you have any sort of relationship with your father, his death will bring about a time of deep inner reflection. Perhaps it's this reflection that brought Jaime around to the fact that he's a father himself, and now realizes that he wants to try and create a stronger relationship with his children than he had with his dad. I personally am in a constant state of thinking about my parents and trying to parse out the things I want to pass on to my son that I learned from my parents and what I'd like to be different as well when I was growing up. Sure, Jaime could be simply searching for some sister snatch, but after all he's been through in recent times, I'd give him the benefit of the doubt that maybe he's finally grown up and becoming something resembling a human. Too little, too late? Most likely, but an A for effort, right? What do you think about this analysis of Jaime?
I suppose it could have a big effect on him as a person. Just thinking about, you know, not necessarily legacy, but, you know, his family more.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing about being a parent. You know what your parents did and how it shaped you. And, like, you try to keep the good and get rid of the bad, but on the other hand, a lot of that bad is beat into you, so it's hard not to repeat the same mistakes, but the desire is always there. I want to take whatever ball we had as a family and move it a little further towards the goalpost, whatever those goalposts are, but do a little bit better than my parents. So I could see that. Sure. I like that. Matt E is batting cleanup. He says, if we can assume that Melisandre is offering her lovely lady lumps to Jon Snow in order to do some dark magic, perhaps to birth a Jon Smoke. Then was Jon's love for Ygritte
and then it's just going to turn into Mortal Kombat 11.
Then was Jon's love, that would be an awesome fatality. And with a very mature,
she makes
adult
a smoke version of yourself, your character, and then it comes and kills you.
Yeah It just flows from her lead. That'd be an adult only version. Was Jon's love for Ygritte an actual barrier to the magic? Would this in turn explain Shireen's presence at the wall? Will Stannis' love of Shireen interfere with the Hot One's plans?
A barrier to the magic. Love is a barrier to the magic. So why would that be suggested?
I think it's because in a lot of magical lore, and I'm not saying Game of Thrones is part of this, love is a protection. Like, you see that
like the Matrix,
you see that you see it in Harry Potter, you see it in like the Dresden Files series. It's kind of similar to like a lot
Interstellar.
Yeah
I mean, essentially,
sure so like that's the one antidote. If someone's trying to manipulate you or use you for a dark purpose, if you have a true love that anchors you, then it kind of it kind of grounds the magical effect.
Okay.
Clearly, you're more receptive to this idea than I thought you'd be. So
no, I mean, could it be? Sure,
right?
Sure, it could be. Is it? I don't fucking know.
My here's my feelings as both a book reader and a show watcher. We are too late in the stream of time with two books to go, 2 to 3 seasons left to introduce new concepts of magic that have not been revealed or touched on as of yet. I think anything going forward better be versions of fireballs, dragons, warging, green seizing, resurrection. I'll buy all that and combinations thereof or more potent forms of those. If something new like Horcruxes or like love being this universal shield or something like that, it's going to be harder for me to swallow it, let alone a guy like you.
Sure.
So assuming that Martin knows that, because that's... The earlier you're introduced, your mechanical aspects of magic, the easier it is to swallow. the later in the game, the more it feels like Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah.
And I think Martin knows that. And I would suspect that we're not going to see any like truly groundbreaking, oh shit, didn't know people could do that thing.
Yeah, I felt like the last one was maybe the baby, the White Walker baby. I was about to say the
same thing. That was a reveal. That was, but even then, that was hinted at. I mean, shit, in season two, Craster, Jon Snow all but said he's leaving his sons out for the White Walkers. Now, were they being sacrificed? That was a reveal of what something we already knew.
Yeah.
But if that had just happened, like, you know, in season four without any kind of buildup, it'd be like, still, what? It on the verge of what the fuck, you know? Mm-hmm. But now we're plowing into season five.
I feel like maybe there's one other shoe to be dropped here with Jon Snow and Melisandre and her, whatever blood magic she's got going there.
Right.
I feel like there's one other shoe they could drop that maybe has already been foreshadowed that I just don't realize
but
is
that's
foreshadowing.
The key. It has to have already been foreshadowed, and you should be able to put the pieces together in hindsight. It shouldn't be no new pieces should be put on the board at this point.
I'm with you.
All right. That's it for email for this week. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you would like to send us more, GameOfThrones@baldmove.com. Again, it's not too late to get those spoiler takes in because we've got the tinfoil spoiler section coming out on Friday afternoon, where it's just the book readers and adventuresome show watchers having a little coffee clatch, having a little talk about where we see things going, making some theorizations and some speculating. You can also do the same on our forums at forums.baldmove.com. What's cool about that is we have separated the show watchers from the book readers. We got a spoiler thread and non-spoiler thread for each episode. So you can get down and dirty in a way you can't do on Facebook. By the way, you can keep up with our releases on facebook.com/baldmove and on Twitter @baldmove. That's all I got.
Okay, cool. Well, we're going to be back next week right after the episode with an instant cast. Until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron. See ya.